my watch. We're bang on time. Hi everyone, I'm Alice Grundy and I'm your chair for today. I'd like to start by acknowledging that we're on Wadjuk Noongar country. I'm from Sydney, I'm from Gadigal country, which is why I stumbled a bit on that. I have to work on my pronunciation. I'd like to pay my respects to the first storytellers of this place and to pay my respects to elders past and present. So today we have a session on why perspective matters. You're welcome to tweet during the session, but I would ask that you check that your mobile phones are on silent, please. We will have time for questions at the end, so make sure you save them up. I'm delighted to be joined by two extremely talented authors today. Rana Gonsalves, who's the author of The Permanent Resident. She's won the New South Wales Premier's Literary Awards Multicultural Prize and been long-listed for the Dobby. She's the recipient of the Prime Minister's Australia-Asia Endeavour Award, is co-founder and co-editor of Southern Crossings, and has a PhD from UNSW. The Permanent Resident was published in South Asia as Samita D'Souza Goes to Sydney, and she is currently the UNSW Copyright Agency Writer-in-Residence. Welcome, Rowena.
Thank you.
And further to my right is Elizabeth Tan, who is a local Perth writer. She completed her PhD in creative writing at Curtin, and her work has appeared most recently in Stories of Perth, which we're launching this afternoon, if you would like to come, 4:30, just here. Overland, Lenny Letter, Catapult, Mascara Literary Review, The Lifted Brow, and Westerly. Her 2017 debut novel in stories, Rubik, was published by Brio in Australia, and I'm publisher there. And then it's been published by Unnamed Press in North America and Wonder Editions in the United Kingdom. Please welcome Elizabeth. These are two very different books in that one is officially a short story collection and that the other one is a novel in stories, although in the States it was published as a short story collection. So I thought we'd start with the origin stories of how these books came to be published. Rowena, can you tell us a little bit about how Permanent Resident came to be a book?
I would like to first of all also acknowledge the Wadjuk Noongar people and to pay my respects to elders past, present, and any elders in the room today. I do this not just to tick a box, but to acknowledge that as a first-generation immigrant, I'm very much a beneficiary of Indigenous dispossession. And I feel that it's really important to state that position. I would like to say thank you to the Australian Short Story Festival for having me. It's an immense privilege to be here, so thank you, Susan. And to come back to the very important origin story of the Permanent Resident, I just felt that I couldn't see people like me in Australian literature, or not as many as I would have liked. And so I thought, you know, I would like to contribute to that long tradition of women writing about women and women like me writing about ourselves. So while this is not in any way autobiographical, I would love to have the wonderful lives my characters have. But sadly, my life is quite boring. But so while they're not autobiographical, they're very much stories about people like me, outsiders in a new place, kind of focus them on Indian women in Sydney. And so that was kind of what I was trying to do, write about people that I didn't see represented in Australian literature, in truth.
And was the book a long time coming together? Did you stockpile stories when your books jettisoned?
Yeah, it only took 18 years. But, you know, I've been writing for a long time. So I wrote these stories in a period of 4 to 5 years. But, of course, those 4 to 5 years are based on 20 years of writing practice. And I was going to say eavesdropping, but I meant observation.
Never impinge on another person's
practice. No, never.
Elizabeth, I'll ask the same of you. Can you tell us how Rubik came to be?
Well, I was kind of at the end of my honours year at Curtin University. I was kind of scrambling for a new PhD project, and I recently read William Gibson's novel Pattern Recognition, which I found interesting because it had a science fictional feel to it, and yet it was set in what was then the recent past. And so I was interested in this idea of science fiction being a language to describe the present day rather than a genre that necessarily extrapolates into the future. And so that was kind of my starting point, the idea of, is it possible to write science fiction about the present? And even though as my collection kind of progressed and I kind of moved away from that kind of science fictional voice, I was kind of just interested in the idea of the current kind of technological and historical moment that we lived in.
Mm. And while it may not have felt like it at the time, in some ways 4 years is quite quick for producing a debut book. Did it take 4 years? Is that right?
Yes, it would have taken 4 years.
And several of the stories were published on their own along the way. Did you feel as though you had different reactions to them as individual stories than as a collection or a book? Or is it hard to get responses to literary journal publications?
I'm not sure. Like, I think as I was writing, I was worried that they weren't connected enough, and it wasn't until they were all together, and I gave it to my sister to read, and she said, if anything, they're too connected. It's too much like an episode of Lost, where like there are like the references everywhere to the other stories. So yeah, I think I needed to. It was a unique moment when it all came together, and like I could actually see it as working as a novel and not as a series of separate stories. Yeah.
So, for each of you, I would like to know how you determine the perspective of a story that you're working on. Whether this is something that you set out trying to achieve something in particular or an experiment, or whether it's something that changes over the course of writing a story. Rowanna, would you like to start?
For me, I always start with, rather than with character or plot, for me it's always a cluster of words on the page or a sentence that feels good or looks good or sounds good to me personally. And from there, from that kind of focus on the words, it kind of branches out into a story. And so the perspective is, I suppose, ingrained into that those words that emerge at the beginning. I think perspective is also an ethical choice. And I know you're thinking of perspective. We are thinking of perspective in terms of craft and also in terms of positionality as writers. I think the two are interrelated and almost inextricably entwined, actually. But I think perspective is an ethical choice as a writer, and often that kind of emerges in the process of writing. But also it you can look back at the work and then make a conscious choice about the perspective that you've adopted or the perspective that I've adopted in a story, because I think it's very important for me as a writer to make sure that I am being honest, first of all, serving the work, being honest to the characters, being honest to the story, serving the work, while at the same time being aware of questions of my own position as a writer in the particular society I'm working in. So for me, perspective is an important ethical choice and also a choice about craft. Mm.
And so have you ever written a story from one point of view and then shifted it to another, or chosen to be more closely tied to one perspective than another?
Yeah, that's a great question. I've written a lot of terrible stories which didn't work. Some of the ones that worked are in the book, and they all started with a very particular perspective. I didn't change anything. The ones I've changed, I knew were not working. They didn't make it to the final cut. So I cheated a little bit. The ones that I changed perspective with, they're kind of under the carpet. But these are the ones that are...
Interesting. And Elizabeth, can you talk a bit about perspective in your work and how you determine it?
I think each story kind of it demands its own kind of process and its own demands its own narrative. And so I think I tend to largely arrive at it. It's part of like the many decisions that you come to when you start writing. So most of Rubik's in third person, and I think that kind of the effect of that is that it kind of creates a sense of there being some kind of conspiracy in there, and I guess increases the sense that the characters don't have feel kind of limited agency. But when I was thinking about this panel, I was remembering the process of writing Quan Times 5, which is the last story in the collection, and that's unique because it's written in second person. It's you did this and you ran over here, and it didn't start out that way. It started off in third person, but as I was writing, I realised that the story demanded second person and that kind of sense of alienation that comes from second person, and also because the story takes a kind of video game kind of structure, because it's called Quan Times 5 because the protagonist has 5 lives and she kind of resets and like goes back to a prior kind of save point. And so I needed to lean into that kind of video game kind of feel and structure and that sense of that kind of choose your own adventure kind of feel. Mm. So, yeah.
For any writers in the room, second person is usually the most difficult to pull off. You said that it's alienating, but in another sense it's a kind of forced empathy because it's making you think of yourself as that character. Is that something that you were hoping that the reader would take on?
I think for me, second person has that. It's kind of paradoxical. It's you, but it's not you. Mm. So I think it's an unsettling kind of voice, and so I think that's kind of more what I was going for. And also, I think in the context of this particular story, when lots of wacky things are kind of happening, it kind of gave me a kind of freedom because it's an unusual. It's a point of view that draws attention to itself, and so it kind of already kind of gives the story a kind of surreal kind of feel. And so it was less about empathy, I suppose, and more about just leaning into that strangeness. Mm. I suppose, yeah.
And speaking of strangeness, one of the stories is effectively a narration describing a music video, so it's third person, but it's quite a distant sort of third person, as if it's behind the character rather than behind the camera instead of in the character's heads. Mm. In terms of writing that sort of story, is your focus from the outset on the visual representation, or are you still thinking about developing character and emotion as well?
I think for me, yeah, maybe more visual representation. I do find my characters tend to be very, very in the moment. Tense is also a kind of choice that is kind of a perspective kind of choice as well, because it's the distance from which your narrator is narrating, and so that's a kind of point of view decision. And I think the result of me writing mostly in present tense kind of creates a kind of characters that have an implied history rather than a history that the reader is privy to. And so I think, my characters tend to... I think again, it kind of increases that sense of them not having limited agency. They live in a very precarious kind of state, and so my characters, if they have any depth, it's kind of an implied depth. They're really just in the moment. Mm.
They are very deep, I can tell. Rowanna, there's a story in your collection called First Person, which is a double entendre on the point of view, first person, but also on First Nations people. And there's a little note in the back about how you created the story. Can you describe it for us?
Yes. So that's the story that's literally at the heart of the book physically. And I'd still call it a story, but maybe you won't agree. So what I did was I thought back to my own experience as an immigrant here and what I knew about Indigenous people. What I knew about Indigenous people in Australia in 98 when I first arrived here was what I'd learned in history at school in India, and also from the Tourism Australia websites, the Department of Immigration websites. And that's such a horribly partial, incorrect, outdated, racist view. And I thought that's what I knew, and that's what most people like me who come here for the first time know. And so I thought I really want to chronicle that slippage, that racist perspective that we have as immigrants. And so I took text from different websites and I jumbled them up, and then I used, rather than working with character and plot, I worked with rhythm and tone and repetition and pattern. That's what I was trying to do. Maybe it hasn't manifested in quite as articulate a way as I would have liked. But so I was trying to work with rhythm and pattern to create something that had a beginning, a middle, and an end, but which which doesn't make any sense, really. So so that was the perspective, I guess, I was writing from, of being a completely clueless racist perspective of a first generation immigrant, and then kind of, you know, taking a breath when you come here and 20 years later realizing that, oh my God, why weren't we told in that sense, you know? Or what was it in the conditions of my socialization that didn't allow me, or didn't kind of give me the agency? Although you can't give your... No, other people can't give you agency. You have agency yourself. So why didn't I not take the trouble to find out, you know, about all of this that I am a beneficiary of? Yeah, so long answer. But
and I think one of the things that makes that story so successful is the humour that comes out of it. And humour is a really important thread in the collection. It comes out a lot, especially in dialogue, I think. Can you talk about humour in the sense of, you know, dramatic irony of the narrator and the reader knowing things that the characters don't, but also humour within the story?
Yes, thank you. I just have a wicked mind. So that, I suppose, it's important to me that the work is enjoyable to me as a writer. And of course I've written terrible stories that are so boring that I got bored with them, and so of course didn't want to subject anyone else to them. So the stories in this collection of stories that I liked, of course not everyone's going to like them, I hope you will, but
I think most people
would. Most people would, yeah. But I think the use of dramatic irony, the use of satire, is also an invitation to the reader to do some more work. Rather than spell everything out on the page, for me it's really important to have those gaps and silences that the tools of satire enable us to I guess, deploy in a text. Because for me, that gap between what is on the page and what is actually meant around it, they're kind of in-jokes as well, which I take great pleasure in writing, and I love reading that sort of work as well. So for me, the tools of satire used in the book are really an invitation to the reader to say, I know this is going to be a bit of hard work for you, but, you know, it's going to be hopefully a delicious process.
Yes. Yeah. You can enjoy it too.
Yeah, you're allowed to enjoy writing and literature. It doesn't have to be boring to be considered good.
Elizabeth, I think I said to you when I was editing your book, I must have read it 6 or 7 times, and still every time it made me laugh out loud, which I think is a very good sign. Humour is a really important tool in Rubik. Can you talk about how you use humour and whether it seemed as though it was sort of a happy accident, or whether it was something you were trying to work in on purpose?